This topic here is something that was brought up last year at the MIA conference, and we got a lot out of this, more so because of the speaker. He really did a tremendous job of this. You know, as we're drawing near to the end times, God seems to be revealing more and more to us. Our forefathers were destroyed for lack of knowledge, it says, back in the book of Hosea. So now God is beginning to open up the doors of knowledge with the purpose of helping us to not be destroyed and for us to be able to gain more insight and understanding of Him. And of course, you know, the book of Daniel says that in the end times, knowledge would be increased. Well, as part of the people in the Messianic movement, we've got to be careful about what knowledge we accept and what we see. Most of us came out of the church, or some type of church, and we... some of us were Catholics, some of us maybe a Church of God, Baptist, or whatever, but we're all in a church, and for some reason or whatever reason, God decided to pull us out. And as we are drawn out of these organizations, we begin to see that some of the things that we had currently or previously believed were simply not true. We also began to understand more about certain things, like, for instance, the name of God. Because for the most part, I would say all of us were raised with the understanding that the name of our Messiah was, or is, Jesus, right? Jesus, okay? And is that necessarily correct? Well, we, for the most part, probably just accepted the fact that His name was Jesus. I doubt any of us actually went into and started studying the word Jesus to see where it came from. Can I say that all of us were that way? I don't ever remember in all my years in church of ever having a sermon saying that talked about where the word Jesus came from. Okay, in fact, I really never thought about it. I just accepted it that that's the way it was. But as we began to become a part of the Hebrew Roots movement, what we did is we started studying these things. We started looking in those. And as we started to realize that our Messiah's name was not, His given name was not Jesus, we became very adamant that you know, His name is Yeshua. And we got to the, many of us at least, got to the point where we would say to our friends, and I know I did this, you know, His name is not Yeshua. You know, His name means something, and Jesus doesn't mean anything, right? And so we were somewhat in people's face about that. And then as we studied a little bit more, maybe we, our lack of studying it, we would say things like, well, you know, Jesus' name is just pagan, you know. And we would convey this type of thought. Well, my point here is to help us to see that may not necessarily be true. And what's more, we as a people need to start thinking a little bit more about and studying a little bit more about these things, so that we can, when we convey type of information, it's we know, for instance, that it's true. Now, there is a book that came out about 15 years ago, and it was written by a guy named Lou White, and is now called Fossilized Customs. And I bet every one of us has that book in our library. Well, Lou White has a lot of information in that book that is really good, really good information. And I don't want to take away from what he has done and the work that he's put together. But Lou takes, and in some areas he shows very, he minimizes the amount of scholarship that went into his work. And so he says some things that are not necessarily true. On page 18 of the book, he offers a number of thoughts concerning the Greek language, and though he never comes out and says it, he all but declares that the name Jesus came about as a desire by the Greeks to include the name of their supreme god Zeus in the Messiah's name. Now, there again, Lou doesn't come right out and say it, but he dances around the issue in the whole page there. Now, I understand as we desire to come out of the church or come out of Babylon, how we have this desire to get rid of everything pagan that's in our life. Just rid everything that's pagan. But sometimes we rid things, or we declare and call things pagan that are not really pagan. Because, and I'll say this, the reason we do it is because we have a lack of scholarship on our own. We've heard it, or maybe we've read it, and we assume that the person who is given that information is giving true and correct information. But we come to find out later, a little bit later, that they never did really check it out. Well, Paul, in his second letter to the Colossians, says, "We have not ceased to pray for you, asking that you may be filled with the knowledge of his will in all spiritual wisdom and understanding." So Paul is telling the Colossian people who are new to this walk that he wants you to be filled with wisdom, but the wisdom that he wants you to have is godly wisdom. And part of godly wisdom is learning how to discern not only the information that you're given, but how to disseminate the information you've been given. Sometimes we may have truth, but to convey the truth to a person who's new to this walk may not be appropriate in every situation. So this is the what I would want to do, and my purpose here today then is to show us a little bit more scholastic view of this whole concept of where we got the name Yeshua, and or where we got the name Jesus, so that you'll have at least maybe a little different side of the issue, so that if you're ever asked about this, you can give this information out. Now, much of what I'm going to give you today was given by a guy named Frank Houts, there again at the MIA conference last year, and we had Frank Houts in this area a few years back. Frank is a Bible scholar. He is, his ministry is to come up with books and the type of things that a person can use to really study the Bible. His ministry is more in how to study the Bible than it is in how or necessarily dogma that he has of his own. He's not out there preaching dogma. He's more preaching how to come up with the dogma. Okay, how to find out these things for yourself. So I would assume, and I would say that Frank, knowing Frank now for a number of years, I would say that he's pretty balanced in this stuff, in that he takes in and he just looks for the evidence, and when he gets all the evidence together, he makes the decision. So I think that's a fair way of talking about him. Now, one of the problems we have in this whole name thing is that in our 21st century here, we don't really give an awful lot of thought about what a name means. I name my children, I want them to have biblical names. So we named our children Jason, a very Greek name. And then our other child we named Jeremy, which is a good Hebrew name. We just wanted the name. We didn't really care what they meant. It was just, if it was in the Bible, that's what we want. I mean, I'm not going to say it. But... But I would dare say that's what many of us do. We really don't give much thought to the names that we give people and the children. But back, you know, years ago we did, especially back in the Hebrew culture. In the Hebrew culture, names meant things. And so we come up with the birth of the Messiah, and the angel comes to Joseph and says, and she will bring forth a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. And we see that in Matthew 21. So what the angel is saying to Joseph is that you name your son what he's going to do. And this would not have been at all unusual for that culture in that time, because they always did. And the name that they gave to the son, Yeshua, was not an unusual name. It was a quite common name, in fact. The name Yeshua means, or comes from the root Yasha, which means save. And we saw that word back in Exodus 14, the very first place where the word Yasha was used to actually indicate saving somebody. Back in Exodus 14. So Yasha means save. And of course, from Yasha, we get the word Yeshua, or Yeshua, however you want to pronounce it. There again, this word, this name is not an uncommon name. In fact, we see this name a number of places in the Bible. In Nehemiah 8, it says, "And all the assembly of those who had returned from the captivity made booths and lived in the booths, For from the days of Jeshua, the son of Nun, to that day, the people of Israel had not done so, and it was a very great rejoicing. Who is Jeshua, the son of Nun?
Joshua.
But if you were to get into your Strong's Concordance or into an interlinear, which would be better, you would see that the word Jeshua is actually the word Yeshua. It's actually the word Yeshua. Now, the word, you know, this is the same word that we use for, and it's, the spelling of it is the exact same as the name of our Messiah, Yeshua, even though Yeshua is an Aramaic name. Okay, here's another place we see it. In Ezra 5, it says, "And Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, the son of Jozadak, arose and began to rebuild the house of God that is in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with them, supporting them." And there again, the name there, Jeshua, or Yeshua, is the person actually doing the work. I put in here the names of all of these persons, because if you look at this, this is basically what God is doing right now. If you look, Zerubbabel, who is sown in Babylon, in other words, we're basically in Babylon right now, and we are asking of God, and so He is saved, is going to bring us to Yahweh, our righteousness. So it's sort of a pattern is being spelled out right here in the names of these people. So names really do mean things in this particular case. But if you were to look up the word Jesus in the Bible, in the Strong's Dictionary, what you would come up with is it would say Yahweh is salvation. But we know that Jesus means nothing. The actual letters put together in a word that spell the word Jesus means nothing. The name Jesus literally means doesn't mean anything. Doesn't. I'm not saying that it means nothing. It means that it has no meaning. Is what it is. So how do we get from Jesus to Yeshua? I got that backwards. How do we get Jesus from Yeshua? Yeah. So how do we get how does Yeshua become Jesus? And I spelled it that way because that's the way we hear it oftentimes in churches. So we're going to go through that and look at that real quickly. Before we can understand, though, the process that we go through, there's four things I want us to understand about translating names. First off, nouns, verbs, and pronouns are translated. Basic various parts of speech are translated from one language to another. But proper names are transliterated. And there's a difference. To transliterate means to represent or spell in the characters of another alphabet. So when you transliterate a name, all you're concerned about is taking the A sound and representing that A sound in your own language or in another language with the proper symbol. If you've got an M sound, you're going to make that M, you're going to take the M sound and you're going to represent it in another language or in your language using the proper symbol. We know that the symbol for an M sound in Hebrew is a mem, but the symbol for an M sound in our language is the letter M, okay? So we have to come up with symbols that represent sounds. And in this process, the meaning of the word or the name is lost. So when you take and simply phonetically translate one word to another word, you're not concerned about the meaning of it. You see? You got a quizzical look on your face. Okay. The meaning of the word is lost. And so from the point that Yeshua was transliterated out of Hebrew into Greek, the Greek had no meaning at all. Do we see that? And of course, that carries on.
But how did Yeshua become Jesus?
Okay, well, we're going to show you. That's what we're getting to. Okay, there's a number of transliteration challenges. I'm going to bring up just a few of them here. First off, a sound that is common in one language may not be available in another language. And I'll elaborate on this in just a second. Some languages have multiple sounds for the same letter. And some languages can make multiple sounds from the same letter. So do you see how confusing this could be? We'll go through some examples here. A sound that is common in one language may not be available in another. Example, the Hebrew letter het. All right, we can say het, but do we really say het? Hey, who can say het correctly? It's hech, right? All right. Can't wait. We have nothing to represent a het in English. We have nothing. The closest we can come to it is using the word bach. And if you were to go through and look at all these little Hebrew books, and we got a number of Hebrew books, and describing the word het, they all use the word bach. Because that's the only letter, that's about the only word we can come up that makes that sound, and that's really not the best way to say it. Bach. Okay? How do you say, you know, in English? Or how do you spell it in English? Another example is the letter J. The letter J has no counterpart in a number of languages, such as German and Spanish. Now, that's not to say that the J is not in those letters. I got a Mexican guy works, a legal Mexican guy works for me, and his name is Juan. He spells his name with a J, but his name is not Juan. His name is Juan. Okay, they have no J sound in Spanish. Same thing in German. They have no J sound in German, though the German name for a word for yes starts with a J. And what is that word? I forgot. It's a. No, it's a. Anyway, I don't remember. But the Hebrew word, or the German name for yes, yeah, it's yeah, it's just yeah. You ever heard them talking? They're saying yeah, yeah. That's yes, yes, okay? It's spelled J-A-H, but they pronounce it yah, okay? So they have no J sound in German. So that's part of the problem. Second challenge, some languages have multiple sounds for the same letter. Our English C can have a sound, an S sound, as well as a K sound, right? We can say Joyce, and we can say car, all right? Cat. The T sound can have the hard T, as in Tim, sound, as well as the H sound, as in, or the SH sound, as in condition. Condition. So you can see that if you've got a language, if we had a language and we were trying to translate a word out of English, if we were to try to translate condition out of English, and into Hebrew, what would we come up with to make this T sound? Well, we'd probably come up with a sheen, you know. But unless you knew that this was condition and not condition, you would have a hard time transliterating that, wouldn't you? All right. And then the third problem here is some languages make multiple sounds from the same letter, particularly the S and the Z sounds. And these are all called sibilants because they have this sound. The English has sibilants which are S, Z, C, T, and X. They all make this S sound. In Hebrew, you have the somic, zion, shin, zadi, and tav. And in the Greek, you have the sigma, the zeta, the z, and the psi. So, if you were to take and look at a word in, if you were to look at psychology, if you were to look the English word psychology, and all you knew is how it looked, didn't know how it sounded, how would you transliterate that? It would come up with pyology or something like that, right? Okay, so you see, these are some of the challenges that they have. So Our challenge, though, is to find out how the word at the top, Yeshua, went down through the Greek, Latin, early English, down to modern English. So it made five known changes and probably many other changes along the way. So how do we get there? We're going to work on it. We're going to try to figure out how this symbol over here on the left became that symbol on the right, just to come up with how it got from Hebrew to Greek. All right. I got two slides that show this thing two different ways, but I'm going to go through the long way first, and then we'll go backwards. We'll go back to another one. First off, though we understand the Hebrew glyphs and the vowel pointing, right? So reading, we read right to left in the Hebrew, left to right in the Greek. So the first sound on the right is the yud sound. Unfortunately, Greek has no yud sound. The Greek alphabet has no yud sound. What they do have is a letter called an iota, which makes a long E sound, and that's the closest you can get. So no yud sound there. You got an iota, so you have now a long E sound to begin the letter or the word for Yeshua. The next letter is the vowel point, which is the zerei. You see it down there in the bottom of the two little dots? The zerei makes the E sound. Well, it's sort of an A sound, A sound. And it could be pretty well transliterated by using the Greek eta, which makes a long A sound. So now we have EA. Okay? We've already changed ye to EA, simply because of the first lack of a yud type sound in the Greek. There is no sheen in Greek. There's no SH. In fact, there's not even a way to take and put letters together to make an SH sound in Greek. So since there is nothing they could do, the closest they could come up to was the sigma, which has the S sound. Yes, is what we've come up with so far. The vowel point, which is the shurik, which is the vav with the dot in it, it makes an the purpose of the dot in the vav is to make the oo sound, as in tune. And fortunately, in the Greek, there is the letter omicron that makes the same sound. So that one was okay. That one came over pretty easy. And then the next thing is that the ayin, the last letter in the Hebrew, is a silent guttural. There is absolutely nothing in Greek that comes even close. So it's assumed that that was simply left out. Now, one of the sources I read, they said that the shurik and the ayin together make a diphthong, which is a combination of words to come up with a different sound. I guess that could be true, too. I don't know. I'm not a scholar on this stuff. I have to depend on the other scholars and then sort of weigh it in and look at all the different information. So according to what Frank says, is that it just simply had to be discarded because there's no way to make the ayin sound, because ayin is a guttural and it has that deep throat sound. And there's the Greek language has nothing there that will do it. And then finally, we have the patah at the bottom of the ayin, which is an ah sound. Normally, and this is something I don't quite understand, but he says that this makes the u sound, and it was represented by the u sound. And he didn't really come up with an explanation why the patah was represented by an upsilon, which makes an u sound. All right, so far what we've got is we've got the E-A-Su, which is the which would be a transliteration of Yeshua. But we say it's E-A-Sus. Well, the reason it's an Iesus is because in Greek, they add a final sigma, which is the S sound, because it's a masculine name that's the object of a verb. That's how they delineate the object of a verb when it's a name, by adding an S to it if it's a male, if it's a masculine name. And this is a matter of controversy to some. And we're going to go into that a little bit more. So this is how we come up with the word Iesus. Iesus. Okay? You see that? And we're going to have this on our website if you want to get this off of there. All right. So we're going to go through here and we're going to do this a little bit differently this time. And here we're going to take the Hebrew and we're going to write it from, instead of from right to left, we're going to write it from left to right, and we're going to put the word, the letters in there. And here we have the Yud, and the Yud becomes the iota, remember, makes the E sound. Then we have the Shurik, is that right? No, Zerei. The Zerei, which becomes the N, or that's not an N, that's a, what did I call that thing before? Let me get my notes here. See, I'm not a Greek scholar. Don't think that I'm even attempting to be so. It's a sigma. Sigma, yeah. No, I'm sorry, it's not a sigma. It's an eta. Eta. E-T-A. So the shurik underneath there makes the S sound, and it's represented in Greek with an eta. Okay? Next is the shin, and the shin makes the is substituted with the sigma, which makes the S sound. And then finally, next to that we have the shurik. Is that right? Yeah, shurik. And it's represented by the omicron, which makes the oo sound, which is exactly what the shurik does. And then we have the ion that is not used. So we're going to X that guy out. And then finally, we have patah at the end, the vowel point patah, which normally makes an ah sound. And from that, we get the oo or the upsilon. And then, of course, like I said before, the masculine words, we add the final sigma to get to make this a proper Greek name of a male. Without the sigma, it would not be a proper Greek name. So that has to be put in there. And that is a law, or that's a rule in Greek that's often overlooked by the people who want to say that there is an intent in making this a pagan name, because of this S added to that. All right, so let's go further. So here we go again. We've got Iesus is the Greek. Now, final sigma in the proper masculine names. This is a big question. And we need to understand that this was not done exclusively in the name Jesus, to make the name Jesus. But in fact, this is quite common throughout the Bible and quite common throughout that day. Let me see. Before I go, what we're going to be using here is the Septuagint. Now, does everybody understand what the Septuagint is? Okay, the Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Tanakh. It was done about 200 to 300 BCE, before the time of Jesus. It was done by Jewish priests and Jewish rabbis. Being that the writers here were Jewish priests and Jewish rabbis and were not in any way Christian, okay, because there wasn't even such thing as Christianity back then. If there is, being that these were Jewish priests and rabbis, they had no reason to try to take and corrupt the name of Jesus, Yeshua, or anybody, okay? They certainly wouldn't want to corrupt the name of Joshua, because Joshua is a hero, right? So, and remember, Joshua is the word, his name is spelled Y-E-S-A, or the same way Yeshua isn't spelled, right? Jesha, okay? So let's look here and see something. This is from the book of Judges. It says, "And there was a man of Mount Ephraim whose name was Micah." All right. Look at Micah, how Micah is spelled in here in the Septuagint. What is this letter right here? That's the final sigma. So his name is actually, or is pronounced Micaiah or something like that. It's going to be pronounced with that S at the end. Because the Greeks, when the rabbis took and the priests took and translated the Septuagint, they used proper Greek grammar to transliterate the name. And they added an S to it because that's just what you do. Another example. So Moses, or let's say it this way. So Moshe, we all know that the Hebrew way of pronouncing Moses is Moshe, right? And Moshe rose with his assistant Joshua, and Moshe went up into the mountain of God, Exodus 24:13. How did they, what did they do to the word Moshe? Why do we have Moses? Why do we call him Moses? We're doing it because that's the way it was done in the Septuagint. That's why we call him Moses. And Joshua's, you might say, okay? Look at, if you ever go and open your Bible to the book of Zechariah, and you got a little heading on it, it tells you a little bit of brief history of Zechariah. How do they pronounce Zechariah? Zacharias. How do they pronounce Isaiah? Go to the beginning of your book of Isaiah. Isaias. Okay? All of these names, when they were transliterated into Greek, they added the S. If they were males. It happens all through it. The only time you'll see it not translated with an S is when it's not a subject of a verb. All right? For instance, there is a time when Jeshu. Jeshu was one of the priests. He was the seventh course of the priest. Jeshu, in that case, does not have the S added to the name. So instead of being Iesus, it was Iesu. Iesu. And it's because Jeshu was not the object of a verb. He was just being listed along with 23 other Jewish men, or I guess they're Levites, in the course of the priest. That's the only time you'll see it without the S. So then the question is, how do we get Jesus on down to English? The next step we got to go through, though, is the Latin. So here's Jesus down to Jesus, however you want to pronounce it. We're going to go through that process. So here we go.
How come not from Hebrew directly into Latin?
Because that's not the way it was done. Greek was the language of the non-Hebrew speaking people. And of course the Septuagint, what was the purpose for the Septuagint to be written? It was because there were Greek speaking Jews in Alexandria and many other parts in the Middle Eastern area that could not read the Hebrew. Okay? So that's why they translated it into Greek. So that's why we have all of those previous ones. That's why the Septuagint's in Greek instead of in Latin. Now, Latin was added about 300 years later. You know, Latin didn't even come into as a language until about 200 AD. So, it's much older. Or much younger. Yes.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So, from going from Greek to Latin, the iota becomes the Latin I. Now, Latin uses the same letters that we do. Our lettering system is basically Latin. Okay? So the iota becomes an I in Latin, and the I has sort of an S sound. It's not I like we say, it's sort of an E. It's sort of an S sound. Okay? And then I forgot what this thing was called. The eta. The eta becomes an E in Latin, and the E in Latin has a long A sound. Okay? And the reason is because Iesus. That's what the, remember the Greek pronunciation of the word was Iesus. So they're trying to find letters that sounded like their like the previous sounds, okay? So we have the eta becomes an A, or becomes an E, though in Latin the E had more of an A sound. The sigma becomes an S, and in both cases, and when I say both cases, remember, Iesus had two S's in it. It had a sigma in the middle and then a sigma at the end. And the sigma at the end was because it was a male name that was the object of a verb. So the sigma becomes an S. The omicron and upsilon, which are the O and the U looking letters up there, both have the U sound. And so they simply become a U in Latin because there's no need to change it. The U in Latin goes right along with the omicron and the upsilon. So there's no need to change it. So from that, we come up with Iesus. It's sort of like, it's not like saying Yah-sus, it's like Iesus. And if you say it fast, it's Iesus. So it sounds like a Y, doesn't it? But it's really a Iesus. Okay? Iesus. So that's how we come up with the Latin name to represent Yeshua. Iesus. Now, there is no transliteration between Latin and English. Because the Latin letters make the same sound pretty much as they do in English. So there's really no transliteration that has to be done. The only thing is, for our benefit, or that we need to understand, is that in Latin, the I, J, and Y all have the Y sound. Okay? They all have a Y sound. So if you were to get a Latin word and it had an I, it could be ya. Or a J could be ya. Or a Y could be ya. They all carry the same sound. Now, about 1000 AD, there was the Norman conquest of Britain took place. This is when a bunch of French. A bunch of French, led by William the Conqueror, I think it was, went in and overthrew the British monarchy at the time. And they brought in a French influence. Well, how many of you speak, who speaks French here? Anybody? Okay, well, if you've ever listened to them speak French on TV, you know, they have the, you know, all their food is a something, you know. You know what I'm talking about? All right. They have this J sound, okay, in all their words. Laissez-faire, you know. They just have a J sound. So they put the J sound into the English language. In fact, if you were to read a little bit about the Norman conquest of Britain, they'll say one of the biggest things that happened as a result of that was a change in the English language. Because they had a tremendous change on the English language. I don't know.
Seems like I've heard that word. Very general, like German. Old English.
All right, so that they put the J sound in. And also, the J or the I, I get different stories about this, but some say that in the Latin and then the early Germanic languages, they had I's that eventually started dropping below the line. And so eventually they adopted that curve type thing. Is the way to write the I was to drop it below the line, and then they eventually started moving it over in order to keep it from running into the next line down. And there's a number of theories about this. You know, there's no 100% accuracy on this stuff, I would assume. But eventually the Jesus morphed more into the Jesus over a period of time. Okay? So do we see then how we get the Jesus? Do we see the path that was followed? All right. Okay. Now, there's the question then about was there an attempt by the Greeks to attach, when transliterating the name from Yeshua, was there clear evidence that there was an attempt to add Zeus to the name? Right. We're going to look at that real quick. Jesus equal Jesus, all right? Or Jesus, which is what some say. And that's what is inferred in fossilized customs. All right, look at the spelling of Zeus there at the top. Those are to the right there, that is the Greek spelling of Zeus. You see the S sound, the S at the end? Why would it be an S at the end? Because it's a male name. It's a masculine name. All right. And then look at the Greek spelling of Yeshua, Iesus. Pretty close, aren't they? Kathy was shaking her head yes, and then she decided, oh. All right, not likely, okay? Not likely. If they were an attempt to take and make Zeus out of Yeshua, they did a pretty sorry job doing it. Because the lettering was there, the sounds were there, they could have easily done it if that's what they wanted to do, Jim.
Since Zeus was a Greek main god, would it not have a sigma on the end of it too?
Zeus, it does have a sigma on the end. That's the sigma right there. It's the final sigma, okay? It's a final sigma. So there again, you know, if they wanted to do it, they could have done it very easily, but obviously that wasn't the intent in doing so. All right, so what's that?
It would have
showed up. Yeah, it would have showed up a long time ago. Okay, so based on the evidence, I think that we can make a pretty clear case that Yeshua was the intent of the Greek translators was not to add or make a pagan name out of the name of the Messiah. And the evidence we have is the way that the Greeks had to transliterate names and the evidence from the Septuagint and the way that the Greek names were translated in the Septuagint. So I think that we can make a really good case. And so since that is the case, let us all be very careful in when we try to present this type of information to make sure that we've done a little bit of studying into this stuff to try to determine if it's true or not. You know, there's the website out there that's called Snopes. Okay, however you say it. You know, that's supposed to be the attempt for most people before they pass an email on to 6 trillion people in cyberland that something is actually true. Well, we need to at least try to do that ourselves. We need to try to look a little bit in our Bible and get a little bit of the background to see for sure that this is the name. And the reason we want to do this is simply this, is that this is a very young movement, the Hebrew Roots movement. There's a lot of people coming out of the churches. We don't want to take and tell those people who are sort of jumping back and forth or maybe can't quite make their mind up what they want to do. We don't want to take and tell them that the person that they've been worshiping all these years is a pagan god. You know, let's give them credit. Let's give the church a little bit of credit. You know, not everything that came out of the church is pagan. We need to be, you know, what does it say?
Wise as
servants and harmless as doves. And when we try to do this, and going out there and making bold, brash statements like I myself did about things, exactly this particular thing, you know, we need to think a little bit more about it before we do it.